The headlines: Iran's president says an ex-U.S. administration has no choice but to return to the international agreements abandoned by the current government. A government delegation from Bahrain arrives in Israel, the first such trip since the two sides signed a normalization deal in September. And also on our headlines, a powerful storm, Iota, batters Central America, causing heavy floods and killing at least six people in Nicaragua. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's president Hassan Rouhani says an ex-U.S. administration has no choice but to change course and return to compliance of international agreements. Rouhani said the possible change in the U.S. foreign policy will provide an opportunity for lifting sanctions against Iran. Joe Biden, the declared winner by media of the U.S. presidential election, has vowed to rejoin the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. That's the accord incumbent President Donald Trump abandoned in 2018 and imposed tough sanctions on Iran. Rouhani called the Trump administration an outlaw that unleashed an economic war on Iran. However, he said Trump has failed to achieve his goals through his so-called maximum pressure campaign. The Secretary of State in the U.S. state of Georgia says Republican Senator Lindsey Graham has urged him to find a way to toss out legal ballots cast in the recent presidential election.
Senator Graham applied for us to audit the envelopes and then throw out the ballots for counties who had the highest frequency error of signatures. And that I tried to, you know, help explain that that's because we did signature match, you couldn't tie the signatures back anymore, you know, to those ballots. We got off the call and I said I would circle back, and I talked to counsel and I get back to them. And we just decided the best action was not to, you know, get back and re-engage.
Irregularities. Deserve a chance to make
Graham disputed those comments, saying he has only called for toughening voter ID laws. Post-election chaos in the U.S. continues amid President Donald Trump's claims of voter fraud. On Tuesday, he sacked the country's top cybersecurity official, Chris Krebs, had confirmed that the presidential election was highly secure. Meanwhile, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has rejected the Trump campaign's lawsuit regarding election observation in the city of Philadelphia. The lawsuit was one of several suits the Trump campaign filed in key states where his Democratic rival, Joe Biden, was projected the winner. Colin Campbell says there are a lot of disturbing implications from the actions of U.S. President Donald Trump during the recent weeks.
Yeah, there's a guy who was a director in the Department of Homeland Security, and the president now got rid of him. This is the latest in a series of firings over the past week after his loss in the general presidential election of 2020, a much-anticipated election, and many would argue one of the most consequential elections in recent American history. So this is, some would say, is out of anger that he lost the election, and we do see Krebs as a very pivotal person in all of this, one who has defended the integrity of the election, as the president has alleged voter fraud, not just voter fraud, but rampant voter fraud across the nation, telling his supporters, many of whom made up about 70 million Americans, that there was voter fraud in various states, which is why he lost the election. There are a lot of disturbing implications from what the president is doing, and the response, or lack of response, rather, from Republicans is quite concerning. Some would say, frankly, disturbing.
Powerful storm Iota has battered Nicaragua's coastal areas, killing at least six people, including two children. Iota is the strongest storm on record to hit Nicaragua. It made landfall there late on Monday as a Category 4 storm. Iota has brought winds of 249 kilometers per hour and caused flooding. It has affected more than 400,000 people in the Central American country. Nicaragua is still reeling from the impact of another powerful hurricane, Eta, that battered it 2 weeks ago. On this edition of the News Review, a Bahraini government delegation has arrived in Israel on the first official visit there since the two sides normalized ties in September. Bahrain's Foreign Minister Abdel Latif Al Zayani is leading the delegation. He's set to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and visiting U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in Jerusalem on Al-Quds. Al Zayani is due to continue work on a memorandum of understanding between Bahrain, the one that Bahrain and Israel signed in Manama in October. Those MOUs include the opening of embassies. Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates signed U.S. brokered normalization deals with Israel at the White House on September the 15th. Palestinians have called the deals a stab in their back. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Mr. Saeed Shahabi, who's from the Bahrain Freedom Movement, joining us from the British capital, London, and journalist and commentator Laith Maruf is joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Shahabi. Give us your thoughts on the recent Bahraini government delegation visit to the occupied territories.
Thank you very much. Another black day in the history of Bahrain. Among many, many black days since this regime has embarked on pressing and on pressurizing the people on one hand, and also making links and normalizing relations with the enemies of the Muslim Ummah. Now, this visit today is just another step in the back of the Palestinian case, but also it is a betrayal of the of trust, is a betrayal of the case, is a betrayal of the Bahraini people. It is an attack on Bahrainis, not only on Palestinians, but Bahrainis also are really incensed and angered by this outrageous policy of this murderous regime of the Khalifa dynasty. To us, it is not surprising to see that they are lining themselves along with Israeli occupiers who have been repressing and suppressing the Palestinian people for the past 75 years. Today is another black day, as I said, among many black days under the authority of this hereditary dictatorship of the Khalifa dynasty. And the people have been silent. Many of them who have been to demonstrate and protest against this normalization have been arrested, including children under 12 years of age, including Agher, who was only 16 3 days ago, who was arrested because it protested against this betrayal of the Palestinian people by the Khalifa dictatorship.
Laith Maruf, Mr. Shahabi believes that this is a black day in the history of Bahrain. It's also a black day for Palestinians, as one might see the Arab governments effectively turning their back on their Arab brethren, the Palestinians.
It's important to remember that the ruling family in Bahrain, as well as in Qatar and the United Arab Emirates, were all installed by the British in the 1970s and given, you know, just the fabricated independence at the time in fear of the Arab national unity movements and the socialist democratic movements that were waving across the Arab world. The Bahraini people resisted since then the occupation by the British and then the installment of this ruling family that doesn't even belong to Bahrain, that is just a branch of the Saud family, similar in Qatar and the Emirates, installed foreign rule basically over the people. And Bahrain has a special situation where the majority of the population are Shia, and although they have been rebelling against the leadership imposed on them in Bahrain, it wasn't for religious reasons, but for democratic reasons and Arab unity reasons. So we see that the struggle of the Bahraini people is related to Palestine, is related to liberation and unification of the Arab people and liberation of the Muslim people as a whole, and is part of the anti-imperialist struggle that we live in our region.
Mr. Maru, staying with you, can you tell us more about the implications that these normalization deals could have for the security of the region at this point?
Well, it's clear that the Bahraini elite and so much of the Gulf countries have been collaborating with apartheid Israel since their inception as fabricated states. So really, this changes nothing, neither for the Palestinian people who have been resisting without the help of these Gulf countries, neither for actually the people on the ground and for Iran, because if the real intention of this is to create some military alliance between these Gulf countries and Israel, that has been existence since the 60s. In the war in Yemen that we see today, and what happened in the 60s, similar, and in the repression of the people of Bahrain that has continued no matter what with the help of the apartheid Israel. So it doesn't change anything to the military formula on the ground, neither for the Palestinian people. Actually, things are in the open right now, and it's better for all of us.
Mr. Shaabi, final thoughts from you. The Palestinians have called these deals stab in their back with the silence of bodies like the Arab League. One might think that the Palestinians have a right to feel that way.
Well, of course, Palestinians have the right not only to feel that way, but to feel that Palestine belongs to them, to feel that they deserve to be supported by their Arab neighbors, Arab and Muslim neighbors, and of course the freedom fighters all over the world. They deserve to be supported, but unfortunately our countries are ruled by these tribal elite whose main concern is their own well-being, their own wealth, amassing the wealth they steal from the people, and at the end of the day to align themselves along those dictators, along those occupiers. Now, with the change in America, there is a very, very, very faint hope that maybe something may happen, but it is very unlikely that the United States will ever become one of the countries calling for self-determination or accepting democratic transformation in the Arab world, because to them, democracy is an enemy, especially in the Arab world, especially in the GCC countries, which has a lot of oil, and they do not want any free person, free ruler to rule. This is why they wage their war against Iran, because they want to be independent in their decision making, and that is not acceptable if it is going to happen in Saudi Arabia or in Bahrain or in the UAE. So to us, today is a black day, but there are a lot and many bright days ahead. We have hope that our people will rise, not only in Bahrain, but in Saudi Arabia, in the other Arab countries, will rise again and change this bad situation into a better one, ruled by the people, where the people have the right to exercise their own sovereignty and rights.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Saeed Shaabi joining us from London. Also, thanks to Mr. Laith Maruf speaking to us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Welcome back. Israel has carried out airstrikes on the Syrian capital, Damascus, killing 3 military personnel. The Israeli army said its warplanes targeted military sites belonging to resistance groups. Sources from the Syrian army said one serviceman was also injured during the aggression. Syrian media have reported that the country's air defenses intercepted a number of Israeli rockets which were fired from the occupied Golan. Israel frequently targets military positions inside Syria, especially those of the resistance groups, which have played a key role in helping the Syrian army in its fight against terrorists. Our correspondent Muhammad Ali is joining us now from the Syrian capital, Damascus. Muhammad, tell us more about the recent Israeli airstrikes hitting the Syrian capital, Damascus.
Yes, the Syrian military, an official military source, confirmed the Israeli aggression and said that about 3:11 a.m. Local time in Damascus, Israeli fighter jets attacked from the occupied, over the occupied Golan Heights, Syrian military positions, and that the Syrian air defenses were directly activated and were able to intercept, shoot down several enemy missiles. The result, according to the Syrian military source, was that three military personnel were killed and one soldier was injured over there. Now, Israel does not usually admit its attacks on Syria, but this time it did, and gave actually a detailed statement. Now, the Syrian, the Israeli military admitted its airstrikes, saying that it targeted both the Syrian army positions, and also claimed that it attacked areas commanded by Iran's Quds Force. This is what Israel said in a statement, and confirmed that it attacked storage facilities, military compounds, and Syrian surface-to-air missile batteries that were used in repelling Israeli attacks, actually. Now, those Israeli attacks, according to the Israeli statement, come after a Syrian military squad led by or commanded by Iran planted three explosive devices in the occupied Golan Heights. This is what Israel is claiming. Now, Israel always uses such claims in order to justify to the international community its attacks on Syria. Those are illegal attacks at the end of the day. This is a sovereign country, and Israel continues to attack it since the start of the crisis in Syria. Now, the Syrian Foreign Ministry usually sends letters to the United Nations when such attacks happen. This time, still, we didn't hear a statement, but usually the Syrian Foreign Ministry says that all of those Israeli attacks are in direct support of the remaining terrorists inside Syria. It's a message from Israel to those terrorists that Israel continues to support them. And also, the aim of such Israeli attacks, according to the Syrian Foreign Ministry, usually, is that those attacks only aim to weaken the Syrian army. Israel said in its statement that it attacked areas and positions, military positions for the Syrian army that stretches from the occupied Golan all the way to Damascus, for example, areas close to the Damascus International Airport and areas south of the occupied Golan.
All right, thanks a lot. This is Muhammad Ali joining us from the Syrian capital, Damascus. Well, employees of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees have staged a sit-in protest in the Gaza Strip to demand their full salaries. UNRWA has been struggling with financial problems after the U.S. decision in 2018 to halt funding the agency. Asher Shannon has more in this report.
UNRWA employees went on partial labor strike to slam the agency's failure to pay their salaries. UNRWA has announced that workers would only receive part of their salaries for November and December due to budget deficits. The UN agency provides education, health, and welfare services to millions of Palestinian refugees in the occupied West Bank, Jerusalem al-Quds, the Gaza Strip, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. More than 1.3 million Palestinians live in the Gaza Strip and rely on UNRWA aid to survive. With some 13,000 people on staff, UNRWA is the main employer after local authorities in the blockaded Gaza Strip, which is home to about 2 million people.
The decision to delay or pay partial salaries is a grave violation of the rights of employees. It will only increase the sufferings of the Palestinian refugees at home and abroad. This is an unprecedented situation and will have dire consequences, especially in the Gaza Strip.
UNRWA is suffering from a huge budget deficit that has forced it to cut back its services to Palestinian refugees in recent years, including the provision of urgent relief and emergencies. The Israeli regime has been campaigning to defund the UN agency in an attempt to end the refugees' right of return. The crisis worsened after U.S. President Donald Trump decided to cancel funding to UNRWA in 2018.
The U.S. funding for UNRWA stood about $360 million each year. So after the U.S. decision, UNRWA was forced to lay off 116 emergency employees. This is the worst budget deficit that we have been experiencing over the past years.
UNRWA is a United Nations agency established by the General Assembly decades ago and mandated to provide assistance and protection to Palestine refugees across West Asia. According to UNRWA, there are over 5 million registered Palestinian refugees.
This partial payment of salaries will have a big socioeconomic impact on all UNRWA employees.
all services to Palestinian refugees will be hampered because of the budget deficit, including health, education and aid.
The plight of Palestinian refugees began in 1948 upon the creation of the Israeli regime on occupied Palestinian land.
Palestinian refugees say that UNRWA cuts will only deepen the suffering after more than 7 decades of displacement. Ashraf Sharan, Gaza.
That's a wrap for now.
Bye, everybody.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Inside Israel. Israeli anti-regime protesters continue their protests. They've been taken to the streets since the beginning of this year, demanding the resignation of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. They also want an end to his cabinet, and technically they want a fourth election, after 3 elections failed to yield any political change.
I'm here because I feel we have a corrupt and incompetent government and Prime Minister, and political discourse that's very dividing, divisive, and hateful. And we're led by criminals, and we want to put an end to it and make a difference.
They cite a worsening economic situation, no real opposition, Netanyahu's corruption trial, and Netanyahu's growing power as their motives for their continued protests. They also cite the political deadlock and the unwillingness by the different political parties to compromise. These protesters disregarded regime lockdown orders and continue taking to the streets during Israel's second lockdown that ended in mid-October. They also defied an outright ban on protests, which they said were illegal. These anti-regime protesters say that nothing will stop them from taking to the streets unless the cabinet dissolves. tens of thousands of Israelis have been taken to the streets in anti-regime protests. They've been doing so since the beginning of 2020. They have recently escalated. Israelis are having a tough time, and they want Netanyahu to resign and the cabinet to dissolve. Anti-regime protests have been taking place across Israel and in occupied territories. Israel witnessed regular demonstrations against the premier in defiance of a total ban on such rallies. The ban, signed off by the cabinet and approved by the Knesset, were purportedly introduced to contain the new coronavirus.
Protesting against our corrupt prime minister, we would like him to leave office immediately. He is driven by his criminal considerations. He is charged with very severe charges, and he should take care for his criminal acts. He should deal with his lawyers, not while he's sitting in his office. All his actions are driven by his criminal considerations, by his legal considerations, and he doesn't do anything good for the country anymore.
But the protesters are budging. They say these protest bans had nothing to do with the virus, but rather to contain them from demonstrating daily. Trust in Netanyahu and his cabinet has fallen dramatically. A survey published by the nonpartisan Israel Democracy Institute reported that 73% of Israelis do not trust Netanyahu's handling of the coronavirus crisis. For these protesters, the gap between citizens whose lives have been so badly damaged and people who claim to be leaders but pat themselves to no end is just unbearable. They believe that the regime has completely detached itself from the people. Suffering and distress have increased all the while the regime in Israel has not offered any meaningful help, according to these protesters. Both Netanyahu and ministers from his right-wing Likud party have labeled the demonstrations as leftist protests and called their participants anarchists. This while members of the cabinet from the left wing demand that police do more to end the protests. Many have been arrested and injured in violent attacks by the police.
Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu is making laws that will try to weaken our protests. It's not comfortable for him that tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands are protesting outside his house. It's not comfortable. It doesn't look good. It puts a bad light on him. And he would rather that we will sit quietly at home. So instead of coming to him and coming to Jerusalem and coming to Caesarea, we are going everywhere around Israel where we can, where it's still close to our house, where it's still legal, with the illegal, non-democratic laws that he is forcing. I think he is trying to ruin or to weaken his opposition. He's doing it with the lockdown. His lockdown doesn't have any sense economically, socially, and also health-wise. No logic. And again, the government itself, the people there are not obeying their own laws. Also, Benjamin Netanyahu is not obeying what he says we must do. And it's a democracy. People are equal. It's not we have kings and we have slaves. I can't promise, and no one can, that we'll get what we want. No one knows what will happen. We know what happened so far, and we know what's happening now. We want a reform, we want a change. We don't want to see Benjamin Netanyahu in power, but it's not only him, it's also the rest of the government. And we want, again, we want an organization. If it's democracy, democracy. If it's a government, so it's a government that works for the people. We don't want people that are working for themselves and for the rich people, and for the tycoons. We don't want a monopoly. We want a good society for everybody. It doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman, if you're Arab, Jewish, Christian, Muslim. We want a just society, a better society, and it is possible. And we want work, we want education, we want health. And
The protesters are on social media too. Gideon says, I really need to know why someone who has won successive elections and is propped up by his rival would walk because a few thousand people are chanting outside his house. Presumably, they voted Gantz anyway. Looks to me like they're going after the wrong guy. Sue sarcastically says, maybe all the unwanted ex-heads of state, including their families, Trump, et al., Netanyahu, Putin, can pool their stolen monies and buy a country to share and live in harmony. Shelley says, this is why the indictment against Netanyahu is so inconvenient and unwarranted. If not for that, Netanyahu might have moved on. Now he has to hold Israel hostage to his politics to promote his personal survival. Democracy isn't supposed to work like this. Mariev says, there is a mini civil war happening on the streets of Israel, with many incidents of far-right Israelis assaulting anti-Netanyahu protesters.
Tell you, listen, about the identity of the reporters, I just already told you and answered that. But as for Mr. Gantz, indeed, you're right. There are hundreds of thousands of people who feel that they voted been stolen by him, by John, and by the moves he did by joining Netanyahu. And he claimed to have done so solely because to protect the people, the public, and the state from Netanyahu. He said that his position as the government is to protect the public and the country from Mr. Netanyahu. But it's about to blow up, all this bubble. It's about to blow up because this government can't function. They really can't do it. So in the next days, we will see what's going to happen. I think we are going to the third elections.
Thousands of Israelis have participated in weekly demonstrations outside Netanyahu's official residence in Jerusalem al-Quds for months, calling on the longtime prime minister to resign while on trial for corruption. Police reported clashes in over two dozen instances with the protesters in the capital Tel Aviv and occupied Jerusalem al-Quds. One of the protest groups warned in a statement that the demonstrations were a warm-up for more intense protests to come. The marches have also been fueled by the regime's response to the pandemic. The economy has been devastated by the closures, and many of the protesters are young Israelis who have lost their jobs. Netanyahu's trial, the pandemic, and the plummeting economy are adding further pressure on his emergency cabinet, which was formed in May in partnership with his elections rival, Benny Gantz. Protesters are also upset that Gantz betrayed many of his supporters and did Netanyahu a favor by joining his regime. The so-called emergency cabinet was meant to address the COVID-19 crisis. It was formed by Israeli political parties after three inconclusive polls in less than a year. Instead, it has been plagued by non-stop infighting. Several ministers have resigned, including the health minister, tourism minister, and the housing minister, along with other senior officials from the finance ministry. They all agree that Israel is in a dangerous place.
I think much more than 73% or 79% don't trust Netanyahu. I think it's much more, even people who chose him, don't trust them anymore. And also, people are changing their minds. I think people understand he's not working for them, that he's lying, that he doesn't care. He's putting blame on other people that are working with them. He's putting blame on the public. It's not a serious man. He's not a serious politician. He's not representing us or anyone. He's helping his own friends. He's helping rich people to get richer out of the little resources we have in Israel. I don't think the sentiments are very fond of Netanyahu in the streets. Obviously, yes. Netanyahu is doing whatever he can to not get into jail, to not get off his seat, and to stay in power. And it's understandable. When you're a politician, many times you have a change in your morale system. Your values change. It happens to many people. I think Bibi Netanyahu is a good example to what happens. Machiavelli said it hundreds of years ago. It's a risk we have. We have the regular people, morals and values. And when people are in power, it changes. And it's very, very difficult for the regular person in the street to understand it. But I think here now it's obvious. The king is standing outside the pool, looking at us, and sorry to say it, pissing on us all and laughing. Bibi Netanyahu needs to be judged for his crimes, and he's continuing to do crimes.
The protesters are on social media too. On Twitter, Free Logic says, "It's so beautiful to see Jews united against the Zionist-run regime. It's the only way for true peace and justice." Stefan says, "This protest happens to be at the site where Netanyahu held a rally in 1995 that many believe incited the murder of Yitzhak Rabin." Noga says, "The Black Flags estimates 170,000 Israelis stepped out to protest against the Prime Minister today. Week after week, for 18 consecutive weeks, thousands upon thousands of Israelis have taken to the streets to demonstrate against Netanyahu."
It is very clear that many people in Israel do not accept the authority of the regime, and it is not that difficult to understand why, because they regard the regime as extremely corrupted collective. This is totally obvious. I would assume that we see exactly the same thing in America. A lot of people within the left, for instance, or within the radical left or the anarchist left and Antifa and so on, are not willing to take, to obey the rules that are set by Donald Trump.
The severity of the protests have highlighted underlying issues. These weekly and now almost daily protests are against the violation of basic civil rights by the Israeli regime. These are mainstream Israelis who are taking to the streets and not Arabs, who comprise of 20% of the population, or minorities such as the Sudanese or Ethiopian communities. These are Israelis who are descendants of European settlers that first touched down in Palestine back in 1948 and occupied it ever since. They feel that Israel has become a dictatorship. Protesters say the lockdowns, mass surveillance, and anti-democratic laws are more rife in Israel than ever before. Here's the news making the press in Israel. YNET News. The Israeli army launched a large-scale military exercise which focuses on a potential war against Lebanon. The Israeli military said the drill, named a lethal weapon, consists of regular and reserve duty forces, including the Israel Air Force, Navy, and Ground Forces, as well as the Intelligence Directorate, the Technological and Logistics Directorate, and the Cyber Defense Directorate. The Jerusalem Post. Hundreds of demonstrations have been taking place across Israel in continuing regular anti-Netanyahu protests that have thousands of participants angered over a variety of issues, ranging from regime mismanagement of the coronavirus pandemic to corruption proceeding against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the economic situation in Israel. The Times of Israel. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced Thursday that next week he will propose increasing fines for educational institutions operating in violation of virus lockdown measures after the reopening of some ultra-Orthodox schools and yeshivas in defiance of the regulations. I-24 News. Nearly 60,000 Israeli businesses could close by next year due to the devastating economic impact caused by the coronavirus pandemic, the Times of Israel reported. Citing a new report released by the analytics firm Dun & Bradstreet, the Times said some 55,000 to 60,000 businesses could see their doors shutter by next year, while another 40,000 new businesses are expected to open.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhis salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام ما من إنسان يطعن في عين مؤمن إلا مات بشر ميتة وكان قمنا ألا يرجع إلى خير.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, anybody who discredits a believer's self-esteem will die an evil death, and he becomes deserving of never again returning to a good end.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. In one of the very profound and beautiful dialogues which we find, which is rather a very long dialogue, but I'm going to just give bits and pieces over the course of multiple programs regarding this dialogue, this conversation between Imam Abu Ja'far al-Baqir alayhi salam and one of his most knowledgeable students by the name of Jabir bin Yazid al-Ju'fi. Now, in this dialogue between Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam and Ja'far bin Yazid al-Ju'fi, we find that Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam talks about some immortal, eternal commandments which are full of high moral standards and ideals through which a human being can become sublime if they put them into effect. Now, some of these commandments are as follows. Imam al-Baqir says to Jabir bin Yazid al-Ju'fi, I commend you to follow five commandments. 1. When people wrong you, then do not wrong them. 2. When they betray you, do not betray them. 3. When they accuse you of lying, do not be angry. 4. When they praise you, do not be happy. And 5. When they dispraise you, then be patient. 5 very simple commandments given to us by Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam in this dialogue, but we find that truly they are life-changing commandments. If somebody wrongs you, do not wrong them. If somebody betrays you, do not betray them. Because wronging another itself is a bad thing. Betraying another person itself is a bad thing. And furthermore, when somebody accuses you of lying, do not be angry, because know that you are telling the truth, so there is nothing to be angry about. And when they praise you, do not be happy, because the praise of human beings is not that important when compared with the praise of Allah. And finally, when they dispraise you, be patient, do not be angry, because again, the dispraise of a people is not what is important when compared to the dispraise, the anger, the dissatisfaction of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Beautiful points, short, sweet, concise, but incredibly thought-provoking and truly life-changing, found in this dialogue between one of the most knowledgeable students by the name of Jabir bin Yazid al-Ju'fi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam himself. Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Just to let you know that when you hear these fatwa from our mujtahideen, you know, people ask this question, oh, mujtahids are giving fatwa, where does it come from? Well, the fatwa in most cases basically are based on the ahadith of the imams of the Ahlul Bayt. Or even if it's not exactly from the wordings of the ahadith, it is based on the principles derived from the Quran and the Ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt. When it comes to the issue of meat products from a Muslim butcher or a Muslim market, and I would like you to, you know, pay attention to the words, Muslim butcher or Muslim market. So if it comes from a non-Muslim company, the rule doesn't apply there. Meat products from a Muslim butcher or a Muslim market, there is no need for you to ask whether it's halal or zabiha or not. You can assume that. Unless you come to know the opposite. Once you have ilm, then your ilm supersedes the general rulings. For example, there was a sahabi, actually two or three of them, Fuzail and Zurara and Muhammad bin Muslim, all of them asked the Imam, Shira'ul lahm fil aswaq wa la yudra ma yasna'u al-qassabun. They asked about buying meat from the market where they don't know, you know, what the butchers have done. And Imam says, kul idha kana dhalika fi aswaqil muslimin wa la tas'al anhu. When you look at the issue of meat, Imam says, if it is from the market of the Muslims, then you eat it. You don't have to ask about it. This is how you begin. This is the, you know, guiding rule about the issue of meat bought from a Muslim market or a Muslim butcher. And of course, everywhere I'm saying, unless it is proven otherwise. If it is proven, then your ilm and your, you know, knowledge about that issue and that situation will prevail over everything.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
An IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.